Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is The Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom to talk about the first season of Castle Rock. I am a huge Stephen King fan, and I was excited for the show. Was excited. Andrew and I talk about mystery box shows, again, about how much of King's work actually makes it into the show, and whether we're on board for season two. This is full of spoilers, so watch the show before listening if you care. It was a great chat with Andrew, as always. On to the discussion! Everybody, I'm joined once again by Andrew Bloom of the andrewblog.net. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Robbie. How are you doing? And by the way, thank you for having me. I'm probably not going to go to a small town in Maine anytime soon, but life goes on.
Yeah, we're talking about Castle Rock, the recently ended first season, 10 episodes. Stephen King based original television show based set in the Stephen King universe, which I have no Stephen King apparently has writing credits for every episode.
I think that's created or like characters by or those sorts of credits. I don't think he has.
Yeah.
I think IMDb puts it as writer, but it's one of those nebulous in the way that like Jack Kirby gets writing credit on modern day Marvel things like that sort of.
I think they're probably different in that Jack Kirby probably gets a lot less money than Stephen King does from Castle Rock. Then I don't think Jack Kirby's family gets like a 1% or 10% cut from the $200 gajillion that Infinity War made.
Are you suggesting that a comics company or some kind of IP rights holder would act unscrupulously or dishonorably, Robbie? Because I can't believe that.
That's a whole nother podcast. I can't get into comic book characters and their creators' rights, all that stuff. It's very frustrating. But no, this is the Stephen King show. They made him wave the scripts in front of his face and he nodded. I'm assuming that's actually what happened.
Faint aroma of horror, I approve.
Yeah, they're just like, look, this is the scripts. He's like, this is what's going to happen. There's nothing is going to happen. He's like, sounds good. We're going full spoilers. This is the whole first season. My one word review, frustrating. as a huge Stephen King fan, Andrew is not. Right, Andrew, you have not read any or very little Stephen King?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm like not a fan of him, but I am, or an anti-fan, I don't know what the proper term is. Detractor. I'm not a Stephen King detractor, but I have not read very much of his stuff. I have seen a number of the movies that have been adapted from his work, but I have read very little Stephen King himself.
Okay, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. That's not, if anyone listens to this podcast, that it's not confusing. I've done multiple episodes about Stephen King novels in chronological order until no one wanted to do them with me anymore. So that you need a partner. I'm not going to do them by myself. That seems a little sad.
And too scary to do alone.
I'm kind of desensitized to all that. Unless it's Bill Skarsgård, then I am not desensitized because at least that was effective. It's frustrating. I had hopes for it because the pitch that got me, that made me go, hey, you want to watch this with me and we can talk about it. It wasn't that it was a adaptation or any, it was an original show developed exclusive, like first for television, you know, like a lot of King's works are obviously he wrote the book first and then they made a movie out of it. And there's varying results to that. Some are very good, and some are absolutely miserable. It just like his books, when you make many of a thing, you're going to get highs and lows. But this is an original for television set in that universe, that pitch. It's a J.J. Abrams produced show. The cast seems, at first glance, seems really strong. It's only 10 episodes. I felt like, oh, like you mentioned it in your review, the idea of a prestige television show set in a Stephen King universe. Hey, I'm on board. I'm interested. I'm a Stephen King fan. What are they going to do? How are they going to pull from that? You know, King himself, when he writes, does that. He alludes to this greater world that is all this stuff takes place in a kind of connected universe. Very connected if you are referring to the Dark Tower series, but that's the thing I actually like the least about this is that they alluded to Dark Tower stuff at one point. But I was hopeful. I thought maybe it could be interesting because it's a relatively small thing. I watched
that noise says it all.
I watched the finale last night, and it's just really that was what this is what this is all this. All this, I just watched all this for that. This is the ending. This. What?
All those 9 hours just to get to this point. Well, so I came in from, if not the opposite perspective, then certainly like the mirror image of it, because I've seen a number of things adapted from Stephen King that I liked, and I've seen a number of things adapted from Stephen King that I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of. And I sort of came into the television show with very few expectations. I'd vaguely heard of it, but didn't really know that much about it. So I could sort of come in and take the show as I found it, without a lot of preconceived notions about what it needed to be or how it needed to connect to Stephen King's other works, or just sort of the baggage that comes with something you're pre-existingly familiar with. And I get reached pretty much the same place, which I think is telling of the failings of the show, that it both failed to please the diehard fan and failed to please the casual observer in both stretches. And I think a big part of that, at least for me, is that it is like every other prestige television show or every other show trying to be a prestige TV show. And does those things in a vaguely horror, vaguely science fiction-y guise, but it feels like a standard prestige television show first and anything else second, and not a particularly good effort at that form to boot.
I did not expect a straight up. I should have expected, hey, a mystery box with Stephen King wallpaper, because that's what this is. It is a plain,
agreed,
plain Jane mystery box show, J.J. Abrams style. And, you know, when I see J.J. Abrams' name on something, that really just tells me, oh, it has money, because how involved is he? He produces how many shows? How many things? I don't think he's like directly overseeing this show. He probably, like Stephen King, glanced at the scripts and looked, and they are turned in. Good job. Goodbye.
I assume he is locked in a big Star Wars shaped box at the moment.
Right. So I don't know. Oh, J.J. Abrams is responsible for the show. I feel like he probably has very general guiding principles over it, and then that's it. But it, when I thought of it, I'm like, it needed to be one of two things, and it needed to satisfy me or anyone, I guess, me in particular, for like, hey, if it really indulges on the Stephen King things, if it really goes in on all the references, now that would probably include a lot of people like you who are not super familiar with most of these things, and they probably go, what is all this? Why? Who are these people? I don't know them. And if it went all in on that stuff, and it was all fan service, like that probably would turn off a lot of people, but I would probably get some enjoyment out of it because I am one of those fans.
And at the same time, I feel like in the modern day, there's more and more nichification of entertainment. And so if you can, especially for a subscription service like Hulu, deliver something that appeals to a narrow band of enthusiasts, but that they really, really want it and are willing to go to your service just to get it, that can work.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I have no idea if it would or would not be successful. I'm just like, that idea appeals to me. And the other one is just make a Stephen King-esque style story set in Maine and indulge in all the Stephen King things and just do it well, which is what they tried to do, I think.
I was going to say that as somebody who is not as familiar with Stephen King as you are, that definitely seems like the approach to me.
There are so few things in here that are nods to the novels. There's not that much. Like, and I have not read every Stephen King novel because there's 150 of them. There's just so many. And the ones, and mostly the ones that have been released relatively lately, which are so long and do not need to be that long. But, you know, and some of them are like, hey, they talk about a rapid dog. It's Cujo. The movie starts, it's Shawshank. Everyone knows Shawshank. Everyone has seen Shawshank Redemption. That's an easy one. But, you know, the woman's Jackie Torrance.
She's the worst name imaginable. It's a good lord.
I love that. I really like that character. That name is
You love her? Like that character?
I like it. I like it.
Robbie.
I like that character because it's the only one with a sense of humor and the only one that feels like it is from a Stephen King story.
I can't really speak to the latter, but I, as much as I wish that there was more levity and more sort of human jocularity in this show, it felt like she was supposed to be the quirky comic relief, and every time she walked on the screen, she should have been carrying a sign that says, like, hey, I'm here to be wacky and wild.
That's the thing. It feels like she's from a different show.
I'm pretty sure they just borrowed Britta from Community and put her into Stephen King.
It doesn't help. I was going to say that exact same thing, that Jane Levy, who plays that character, looks exactly like Gillian Jacobs, who looks exactly like Elizabeth Banks when they're all blonde and they're all they look all the same person. They could play sisters in a film and I would 100% buy it. They look like exactly the same person.
But at least in this instance, they're playing the same kind of character. You could pretty much just imagine, like, honestly, if they just had a quick insert that said, hi, my name's Britta. I just moved here from Greendale. Tell me about the sitch here in Castle Rock. Like, I don't feel like it would change much, if anything, about either show.
I don't know. I like it because it's something that's not so, it's just so dour. It's just so plain, and everything is brown, and Stephen King, his books are spooky. They're not dour. They have humans in them. They have people that do things. Molly and Jackie are the only characters that are people. Ruth is great, but Ruth is also incredibly sad.
I mean, people can be sad. Be sad and still be a person.
I know, but describe Henry to me. It's Henry and the kid. All right, we're gonna do that for this episode.
The Andre Holland character is Henry, and the Bill Skarsgård character is the kid.
Is the kid? We'll keep that very simple because I was looking at reviews and criticisms and comments last night, and half the people were like, "It's white Henry and black Henry." I'm like, but Henry has like the writing. It comes down to the writing. I really think. And it's just, there is these bright shining spots where you're like, wow, that's really good. And that's amazing. And then the rest of it's like, what am I supposed to get out of Henry? Who is he? Like, it starts off, I think, and that last episode really, I hate it. I'll say that. I hate this last, I hated the finale. I hated it.
It was not good. I agree with you on that. It was, again, I had the same reaction you did. All of these episodes just to get to here.
And it feels trite. It feels so, it feels dumb, and Henry feels dumb, and that bothers me, because Henry starts out, and I see what they're going for with Henry's arc. Because Henry starts out, the first time we see Henry, he is defending a woman who's on death row. He's trying to forestall her execution. He tries to break down the glass when the lethal injection messes up. And like, you build up on his backstory and you're like, oh, because he's this outcast. He is empathetic. He cares about people. He's this lawyer who says every client I've ever had is dead. And like, he's trying to care in a life that has failed him in a lot of ways. And I see the arc that they're going for, and that, oh, this incredibly empathetic and caring person who is actually working to try and be good towards people. Like, his job is that, to not kill people. And then it ends with him becoming the jailer like Warden Lacey is at the very beginning of the show. And as soon as I realized that is what they were doing, I was watching on my computer, so I did not, I wanted to destroy my screen, but I obviously did not do that. But it made me, I just had a surge of anger and frustration. I'm like, you didn't, there's, why does he do this? Why? Why? Andrew, why?
He does it because he realizes in the flashback to pushing his father over the ledge that sometimes you need to do evil in order to create a greater good. Or you need to do evil in order to prevent a greater evil from coming to pass. That is my read on it. He gets the memory of what happened to his father back. It sets it up earlier in the finale where the kid says to him, yeah, once you get back to where you started, you can start to put the pieces back together and you know who you are again or something. So they go walking in the woods. Young Henry, or he has the flashback to when he is young Henry, what he remembers hearing his father say and why he pushed him over the ledge. And then he realizes that he needs to do the same thing to the kid in order to restore balance or whatever.
But he...
That Castle Rock was fine before the kid was freed. There's the implication that, you know, all the stuff that had happened in Castle Rock of note happened a long time ago, and then something stopped it, and that what stopped it was presumably keeping the kid away from everybody so that he doesn't cause these terrible things.
What? He has a gun. Why does he not just shoot the kid in the head?
Because that would violate the temporal prime directive? I'm not sure. I mean, the time-space continuum, maybe he wouldn't be sure that he could do it. I don't know. You're right. There's not a good reason for it.
If he wants to kill the kid, I'd get that. Like, kill the kid and just leave him out there. Fine. Like, he tried to kill his stepfather or adopted father. Fine. That's fine. But what? In prison? And it has... there's just a bunch of also, like, logistical plot holes that really bother me. And I know the show probably doesn't concern itself too much with that. But he walks out of a police station like the Terminator. And there's just... dozens of dead policemen and civilians are lying on the everywhere, and they cut to a year later, and he's, oh yeah, I'm a small town lawyer, I'm worrying about trees and plot and like on land plots and stuff. I'm like, what happened when you were held for questioning in like five murders, one of which you are definitely may not be like a actual, like, you may get off because you're defending yourself, but you definitely did kill that one lady and after you like intruded on her house, so there's gonna be a problem there.
Okay, because everybody who kept records or had suspicions of Henry is now dead, so it's fine. It's mob rules. If you kill the people who would point the finger at you, you get off scot-free.
I think eventually the investigators, the people who come to investigate, like, why there's a bunch of prisoners all in that place, and that they have records of this weird kid who broke... like, it was on the news. There was... the kid broke out of an insane asylum and killed 14 people or something.
It was the kid, because as we well know, when there's an instance where you have a young Caucasian man and a young black man who are involved in a crime, you can just blame the young white man, and nobody is going to think twice about it.
This might just become a catalog of how this show failed, but there's not one moment. I think they obliquely reference it twice, the fact that Henry is black, and that might affect things in Maine, in a small town where everyone else is white. And is there another?
I don't want to slate the show for that, because I feel like it is pretty well baked into the subtext of the show, and that even if they're not explicit with it, considering how well they handled some of the things they were explicit with, I like it being, you know, floating in the background of every kind of uncomfortable interaction he has, everybody who looks at Henry a little sideways. If anything, honestly, I feel like it's one of the few things that the show got unequivocally right, particularly in a relatively sleepy town. I don't know how many people would come out and be explicit in their racism, or even to the extent that Henry would feel comfortable confiding with anybody about it. I like the idea that it's always there in the background, and maybe that's my own projecting. Maybe I am seeing things that the show didn't intend there, but I feel like that added to the uncomfortable atmosphere that Henry experiences returning to a place that is both alien to him now and a source of past pain. So I'll put that in the small but significant checkmark, positive checkmarks column for Castle Rock.
I think you have to – I didn't expect a dissertation on it or anything. I just expected them to not – for Henry to himself to acknowledge it to someone at some point, like with his mother or with Alan, like people he is familiar with, maybe with his own son who has never been in this town before and doesn't know what to expect.
Yeah, but for that to be true, his son would have to be something other than an inexplicable prop. And
you're right. You're 100% right. I don't know why his son in the show. Why is his son in the show? Why is his son show up?
To add stakes, that there is a threat to his son and not just himself, and to represent the idea that you have another young man who's in the position that young Henry was, and can he escape from the muck that is Castle Rock, or will he be pulled into it and stained the way that his father?
I mean, but he didn't escape. A lady drove him away. Molly just takes him in a car and they drive to Boston. And you're like, but why? He was on a bus, and then the bus stops at Salem's Lot, which I get it, guys. You want to try and you have to actually do your work to make that mean something. I'm like, and my reaction was like, is he be a vampire? Is that what is they're going to make him a vampire? Because as far as I know, Salem's Lot was abandoned. At the end of Salem's Lot, the book, Salem's Lot is like a no man's land. No one goes there. And if you do, you disappear and no one talks about it. Maybe in 2018, it's been gentrified and reclaimed. And now there's like gazebos everywhere.
Urban renewal is an important part of any community, Robbie.
I know.
Even vampire communities.
Hey, I will give credit, you know, Molly and the real estate and trying to renew Castle Rock was fun. It was probably the only plot line that was any fun at all. Also the murder house, the murder historian people, that was also fun. Although,
yeah, no, that was great.
Even though, again, it
went off the rails eventually.
It didn't feel like it made sense in this show, but that's what I was expecting more like that for the entire show. I was expecting things like that more often, but I guess that would entail that things happened in the show.
It would also entail that characters have such clear motivations and mental states that then they immediately get killed off, because who needs that? People go from zero to murderers. Well, that you can chalk up to the supernatural.
It's the kid.
Stuff, so I'll forgive that.
It's the kid. He does that. Remember, he makes people kill each other.
Even via paintings of him.
Yeah.
He was just in that house. His presence was in that house still.
pretty Satan Bill Skarsgård there, so they had to, he makes you do things.
I hope he puts that on his business cards. Pretty Satan.
I mean,
I make you do things.
He's getting typecast. He's the evil thing. He's the clown in It, and now he's like the kid in Castle Rock to Stephen King productions.
He just has to be cast in one more thing, and he can have a Stephen King trilogy.
There are a lot of conspiracy theories online who say that it is the same character. That is the evil. The evil is there. That's why they cast him in the first place. Because
I am curious. Obviously they knew that he was going to be. Somebody knew he was going to be involved in the other production. If there was any coordination there, any way, shape, or form. But
I don't know. I don't like Henry at all.
At all?
At all?
Not even a little bit?
No, I don't. It got the finale destroyed what I had left of liking Henry. He's like Indiana Jones, except you take away Harrison Ford hamming it up.
I don't know what's left in that situation, and maybe that's the point.
That is the point. Indiana Jones, and it's a thing that got pointed out to me, and then immediately I was like, oh, that's right. And they pointed out in Indiana Jones and the first one, the
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders. He doesn't do anything to make up. Everything in that movie happens if Indy is there or not. Like, he doesn't stop anything. Like, if the Nazis get to the Ark, open it, and it melts them, he doesn't cause that to happen. Like, he's just there. And that's what Henry is. Henry isn't, he's just there. But he doesn't do anything. And it was so evident to me in that finale, because he's in a, when he's locked up in the sound room in the podcast studio, with the, when he's locked up in the podcast studio, he gets in a car crash just randomly.
Hello from WNYC. You're listening to The Voice of God. I'm Henry Beaver.
Exactly.
The Voice of God is brought to you by the Bill and Melinda King Foundation.
It's brought to you by Squarespace. he just disappears for random stretches of time, and it doesn't matter because it's the same if he's there. He doesn't stop anyone from doing anything. Like, the only actual thing that he does is he gets the kid out of Shawshank, finally. Which he doesn't do because they just release him.
It's part of the pressure that he puts on them. All right, so not to get too interconnected with our own podcast cinematic universe here, mm-hmm. I will defend a passiveness from Henry because I think it's kind of akin to Edith Finch in some way, that he's there to uncover the story, to uncover the mystery, more than he is to drive the action. And I agree. I prefer stories where the main characters drive the action and make choices that motivate the plot. But it's not the only way to tell a story. And I think it's valid, even if it's not the thing that lights my fire the most.
I don't disagree with you in principle. It's just that they hinge everything, the final, this gut punch I'm supposed to feel at the end, they hinge it on him deciding, oh, I'm going to imprison this kid. We still don't know what the kid is, other than it's probably a Henry from a different universe. I would hope that's supposed to be true because that's a whole episode, literally an hour of them showing, oh, this is what the kid is. And then the next episode, it's like, oh, it doesn't matter. I'm like, well, why? And Henry doesn't know.
It matters still. It matters still. He's trying to get back. That's his motivation.
Okay, Andrew, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Why, at the very, very end of the finale, the kid looks at the camera and smiles creepily?
So my theory is, this is just my wild out on a limb idea, mm-hmm. is you have the voiceover from Henry's dad talking about how he was the product of the devil or something like that, that his mom tried to smother him in his crib and he came back to life. that since he is the product of that, so is the kid. And that the kid genuinely did come from that other universe, but he does have that, like, supernatural evil, or whether you want to think of it as a supernatural evil, or whether you want to think of it as the, you know, I think some kind of brain tumor that Henry's father had that is afflicting his son, and clearly there's, you know, mental issues afflicting Ruth at this point too. Something along those lines has been passed down to the kid. And perhaps it is inflamed or catalyzed by him hopping universes.
I texted you, their reach exceeds their grasp.
100%.
And I am so tired of anything, all art. I played a video game that was like, that did this, and it enraged me. This show is no exception. It's not the only show that does it. That has a ambiguous ending that doesn't do its work, doesn't show its work, and then expects you to go, "Oh, that's impressive." It's not impressive. It's terrible. It's bad. You're supposed to know what happens in your own show. Don't tell me, Henry decides to imprison the kid, even though he knows what happened to Warden Lacey, because he thinks this town is so evil, and now it's going to be good again. Yet he told Molly to leave. And even though he does imprison the kid, we're not going to ever tell the audience what the kid actually is and if he's evil, because that makes it ambiguous. Hey, tell me the kid is good, and that makes Henry's decision worse. That's something. That's a choice. That's an artistic choice. Or tell me that the kid is evil. Like, obviously, you would tell him that they would let us know a little bit more overtly that the kid is a good guy. There's no evil in him. It's just merely because he's from this different universe is why all these bad things happen. And Henry's decision makes him morally gray to evil. But there was never a point during the show where I go, "Oh, the kid is evil." Because who does he kill? Who dies?
I mean, lots of people die, but I guess for a while, I guess they kind of have their cake and eat it too, because initially you think he's causing the deaths. That's kind of what they go for. And then later they suggest that there's just some negative universe energy, that he shouldn't be in this plane of existence. He should be in his home universe. And so the fact that his presence is here is what's causing these disturbances, not anything that he's causing. But then it seems to go back to it, because in the finale it seems like he is intentionally causing the disruptions with the inmates and everybody else in the police mm-hmm. station. It does feel very inconsistent. A friend of mine used the term tilting at windmills, and I think that is a good encapsulation of what this show's cosmology is.
And this is not a, like, this ambiguity. That is not Stephen King. Largely, you know what the evil bad thing is by the end of Stephen King, a novel or a story. And it might be bad. Like, it might end badly for everyone. Everyone might die, or someone does a horrible thing and that's the ending. But you know what everything is, because that makes things mean something. Like, if you tell me directly, hey, or show me directly, the kid is actually just a traveler trying to get back and really doesn't want to cause all this destruction. And then Henry imprisons him because of his own horrible upbringing and life. I get it. That, okay, Henry is a bad person, but I get it. But then you don't tell me that the kid is a good guy. You say, oh, he may be good. He was, and now he tries to help people once in a while, but he now, but, and all the people he's kind of, all the people who've died are mostly bad guys. Like, the warden was, both wardens are corrupt monsters. I don't care if the lady gets hit by a bus.
she was terrible. She tried to cover up some. She doesn't know what the kid is. She just knows she found some young dude falsely imprisoned for God knows how long, and she's just like, "Yeah, we'll cover it up. Let's make him disappear." And I don't care if she dies. I'm glad she dies. She's bad. She's a bad person.
Well, but you also have that one correctional officer with the heart of gold and that random, seemingly happy family having a birthday. And I will say they were super inconsistent about whether it was proximity to the kid or whether you needed to touch him or when it happened and how it happened and who was immune to it and why. Maybe that's just the ambiguity and the mythos works in mysterious ways, but it did feel very inconsistent.
Well, I mean, it ties back in to the bigger problems with the show in that it's bloated and it's poorly paced. Like, I don't know how – it just keeps happening with shows like this. Like, you mentioned Daredevil in your review, and I largely like Daredevil both seasons so far. But – and it's a problem with a lot of Netflix shows in particular in that
there's – oh, my, yes.
There's just so many episodes of these things, and I'm like, and halfway through, I'm like, why is this still going? Why is happening? Why are we still here? Why do more? Why is this so decompressed? Why are you showing me so? There's a moment I started to notice it later on in this show when it was just long sequences of people driving, and it's not revealing character, it's not revealing setting. Nothing happens. There's no plot. It's just them driving from one place to another. Like, I don't need to see Molly drive to Henry's house. She could just be there, and a thing happens. Why did you do that for 2 minutes? Multiple times? Or that's not the only... Why are we seeing long shots of I don't even remember his son's name.
Wendell, I believe.
Wendell!
The most vital character in the whole show.
Oh, God, Wendell. I don't like why are we seeing long shots of Wendell in a bus and he's just like staring out the window. You know,
it's because this show wants to be Twin Peaks and David Lynch has long stretches of scenes where not much happens because he's trying to create mood. And for better or worse, Castle Rock wants to be the same kind of thing and is not either isn't as good or doesn't know how to use it in the same way.
I don't like Twin Peaks.
I have a variety of feelings about Twin Peaks, which probably should not be attempted to be shoehorned into this podcast.
I will say that I don't like Twin Peaks. I feel like it is this. I feel like Twin Peaks is this show, except twice as long and a bunch of arty crap, a bunch of arty crap that doesn't mean anything. And it's like, oh, David Lynch is a genius. I'm like, it's just a bunch. He's not telling any. What's the story? It's nothing. It's just crap he just throws on the screen because he thinks it's interesting and people go, oh, he's brilliant. No, what brilliant is coming up with a compelling story that makes people care about characters. I don't care. Okay.
I don't want to lay out my... I have, again, mixed feelings about Twin Peaks, but I don't want to lay out both my defense and my criticism of it in a show that is a less... good version of something that you already think is not good.
And I mean, this show, it's crazy to me. This show should be a layup to me. It should, like, this is like, I literally, like, they have the ball. The entire other team is at the end of the court. This is a pick six from the 3-yard line. It should, like, all you have to do is fall over into the end zone and they win me over. That's all it takes. But
the Generals were due, Robbie.
God, we can crusty meme this thing up because this is...
let me ask you one question.
Okay.
It's very curious for me, very interesting to me as somebody who's not really versed in this.
Okay.
How much do you feel like the show fails or succeeds as just any regular garden variety television show? And to what extent, but more interesting, I guess, to my point... do you feel like it fails or succeeds as a Stephen King story? And are those two related or separate?
I mean, I think it connected to my answer earlier about what the two things the show could be. It could be, they could be separate, and you could still make an entertaining product to Stephen King fans, but it doesn't do either. it splits the difference. It makes a bad show and a bad Stephen King vehicle. Because it has, like I said, the Stephen King wallpaper. Because it has characters from other, like Alan is a character in other Stephen King novels. He's a sheriff in Castle Rock, and they some of Stephen King's books take place while Alan is sheriff. Needful Things is the one I've read. I forget the other one was. I looked at all the Easter eggs, but Needful Things is a great book, and like it is emblematic of what Stephen King books largely are, and the ones that people think as very particularly Stephen Kingy. Because guess what? Not all of his books take place in a small town in Maine. Not all of his books are about, you know, a small town like kind of feeding on itself and in evil and all that. There's a lot of them like that, but some of them aren't. But when people think of Stephen King, that's what they think of. And it has that appearance. It has, oh, it's a small town in Maine. It's doomed. There's an evil, capital E, evil. Somewhere, something to do with it. Obviously, we're all doomed because we have.
It was built on a hellmouth.
Yeah, it was built on 7 different cursed things. Various indigenous peoples were. They put curses on them. Blah 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 blah. It has a small town. It has a small like connection, a small web of relationships. You know, you got Ruth. And Henry, and then Alan, and that how that connects to Molly, and how that all connects to the prison, and how that connects to the town, and all the people in the town, and then the kid, and how he, like, all that stuff. Like, that's all, a lot of Stephen King books are about these connections of relationships, and how they all have secrets about each other that they've kept for years, and generally... secrets somehow come out or come up when there's conflict. Like the Alan's and Henry's relationship is the clearest this is a Stephen King thing.
Well, that's encouraging because I feel like my favorite part of the show, aside from isolated episodes, I guess my favorite element of the show is I thought that the Deaver family drama was pretty well done. And in a lot of ways, there was a part of me that said, like, give me a version of this show that is just about a guy coming back to his hometown where he has had a number of bad experiences and finding that his dementia-addled mom has taken up with the sheriff who she was cheating on his dad with 30 years ago. Like, there's enough just there to drive the entire plot of a television program. And I thought, frankly, a lot of it was better done than some of the more horror science fiction elements in Castle Rock.
Well... you're right. You're 100% correct. Those parts are the most interesting parts. And Alan's relationship with Ruth and what he is willing to do for her. And, you know, I love the character of Alan and Ruth. Like, I like the relationship. I love Alan because he is not perfect. He's in many ways a bad person, but he is also willing to move the earth for Ruth. And... like, that scene where he is digging up the dead dog because she thinks it's still alive. Because, to her, it is, as we find out later. But the fact that he's willing to go dig up a dead dog, take a picture of it, and bury it again. In the middle of the night. Like, his devotion to her is a clear sign of the good in him. Of the fact that there is something in him that is still good. And... that kind of character in the setting is really interesting and really fun because it is this town is terrible and awful, but Alan, despite being bad in some ways, also is good because he's willing to do anything for Ruth. And that is what's good about a lot of Stephen King novels is that he captures that complexity a lot of the times with interpersonal relationships. And that's ultimately, I think, what hooks people with Stephen King. It is not obviously a lot of it is about the mood and the horror, but ultimately the monsters are never that great. Like, usually the most compelling monsters in Stephen King novels are the people, not the supernatural thing.
The real zombies were us the whole time.
We are the Walking Dead, Andrew.
We are.
Oh my God, the Walking Dead comic. I don't know if you've ever seen the actual comic book page.
I have not.
Okay, it's literally like Robert Kirkman, the writer of the comic book. I'm just like, we got it, Robert Kirkman. You don't need a character. It's the last page of an issue. He literally screams at the camera, "We are the Walking Dead." That's literally what happens. I'm like, that's, you can maybe be a little more subtle. I know it's a comic book. You can be a little bit more subtle than that. But
I must become Superman 4, the quest for peace.
Exactly.
It's interesting to bring up Walking Dead, because I feel like a lot of what ailed Castle Rock are the same things that ailed the Walking Dead television program. That you have really high production values, some quality actors, some interesting attempts to put a more serious take on what has been a sort of pulpy genre presentation previously. But to your point, it is so dour and often so lifeless and so variable in quality that it becomes hard to wrap your hands around it and warm to it in any way.
And it's just, it feels like it doesn't know what it's doing. It feels inconfident. It feels unconfident. It feels unassured. That's what the ending clicked in place for me. Because it doesn't, like, what are you, show? Because it turns at the end, it's like, oh, this is about Henry making a bad decision and being a bad person in this bad town. And continuing this cycle, whatever. And giving us a zombie face for the kid for a brief second.
Yeah, what the hell was that? That's the one thing where I'm like, good lord.
I don't know if this came out today. I saw this, apparently the creators, maybe to clear up the dozens to hundreds of complaints I saw online about what the hell is this supposed to mean, they said, oh, that's not, it's just a vision of the kid as a very old man. Meaning,
those are the risks when you use Z-grade CGI to try to convey that.
And very briefly, and it doesn't mean, like, again, I don't, it might as well have not happened, because it doesn't communicate anything. It's just more ambiguity. That's what it just muddles the message. And that's like, because Henry, if he's the important thing, and the thing about Henry is that he has realized I have to make the hard decision and I've lost my empathy, he doesn't do anything to lose his empathy. He just, he remembers a thing, but why does he not remember the kid rescuing him from a basement?
I mean, so I don't think that it's, he loses his empathy. I think it's the, just my theory, the episode with the dad, pardon me, the vignette with the dad is enough to convince him that sometimes you have to do a hard thing in order to make better things happen. Though maybe he gets convinced that the kid is evil and he hears the voice of God. I will say, it does feel like a lot, and a lot of my problem with the finale is that it comes off as though the creators threw a lot of stuff at the wall and saw what stuck, or hoped that the audience would see what stuck. You can do that. You can put a lot of ambiguous, opaque symbols in your finale and hope that if you take the refuge in vagary, the audience will fill in the gaps for you. But especially after all that build, it is very anticlimactic and unsatisfying. And say what you will about Twin Peaks, and there's plenty to say for times that it is opaque and hard to deconstruct, there tends to be a lot of clarity about what happened and what the import is and what the show wants you to feel, even if it's something complex and conflicted. If nothing else, the ending just kind of felt like a big blob where I didn't really know what the show was going for, what they wanted us to feel, what they wanted us to believe about these actions. It honestly seemed like there needed to be a lot more that the show did between the scene where Henry tackles the kid and that 1 year later. And it was hoping that we wouldn't notice, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain where we do this time jump that just needed to be accounted for. If not in terms of plot, which I am very willing to forgive, in terms of emotional trajectory and in terms of what we're supposed to take away from these characters.
It's a laundry list of things that we are shown that end up not meaning anything. If I'm to believe that this is, like they've said, this is an anthology show that we are led, maybe we're going to go to the Overlook Hotel next season. I mean, the show will go there. I will not. But the show is going to go back to the Overlook Hotel. perhaps that's at least what I'm, you know, Jackie's going to go there. You get your favorite character.
Tease.
You get your favorite character as the main character next season, Andrew.
Well, you know what? Maybe it'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going to bring my friends from community college, and we're going to stay in this haunted house, and I would watch that show.
Oh, yeah, Community in The Shining mashup—that'd be something.
They kind of did that already.
Yeah, that's true. Community did basically everything that is possible. They did every genre mashup fairly well for a while. But it's just, there's just so many things we're shown that don't, like, what is, why did we know, why are we shown that the voice of God is a thing? Like, that it's real. Like, multiple people hear it. So don't tell me it's not real.
So I took the voice of God, quote unquote, to be something that people could perceive when they're near the convergence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's people to some degree interpreting it as the divine when really it's just a sign that you are approaching this gateway.
I mean, here, Andrew, I'm going to tell you something that you couldn't possibly know. Because you haven't read the entirety of the Dark Tower series, which is the most intimidating of all the King books. That there is a, you know, Dark Tower series is the most multiversal of the King books, because Roland, the last gunslinger, is a guy in a dying world, trying to stop the man in black and all that flag from the stand. The same character is also in the Dark Tower series, and multiple characters from throughout King's works end up in the Dark Tower series, including Stephen King, the author himself, written in, which I alluded to you in a text message.
Does he have godlike powers?
No, he's just a writer. He's just like a pathetic writer who just got hit by a bus, which is what actually happened to Stephen King. But there are a thing called a thinny, which is a tear in reality. And as you get close to this thinny, you start hearing things like in the show. So it's an actual thing that is from the King works. But if you're going to include it in this television show, it needs to mean something, not just, hey, this exists in the King books, so it's here.
Well, yeah, again, I'm not one who wants to give this show a lot of credit, but I, who had very little experience with the King books, understood enough to get that it was a proximity thing. And I think the show uses it to convey in some way what Henry is trying to get away from and yet can't. Like, he wants to put aside his past, but it keeps coming back. He keeps being unable to quell it. And in some ways, the voice of God is a metaphor for that at the same time. You know, it represents his history with his father, the history with his family that is very painful. And it's very hard for him to move past that. And you've got kind of this auditory representation of it. I'll give them that, especially since I know very, very little about the Dark Tower series or other Stephen King mythos, and was able to glean what I thought they were going for.
It's not that I have a problem with it in particular. It's that it ultimately doesn't mean anything in this. Henry doesn't buy into it, I guess, because he obviously thinks he doesn't think the kid is telling the truth. He thinks the kid is just I don't know if he's already out in the woods and why wouldn't he be curious? He doesn't want to see if the kid is telling the truth. He just immediately goes, no, you're not. What are you telling that? Like, the entire mystery of the show is that Henry's coming back and he doesn't remember what's happening. And so he suddenly remembers, oh, I killed my own dad. But this other kid is also saying that this happens. And Molly seems convinced. And why wouldn't I just take a look?
Yeah, but he's still skeptical of Molly, right? I don't know. He does have a decent amount of arbitrary skepticism about these things.
He's just so... And, like, the kid... In that last episode, he's talking to the kid. They have a back and forth, and I thought, okay, this is finally going to be the moment where why can't the kid just say, I'm you from a different universe? Like, just talk like people.
Well, he isn't him from a different universe. I guess he explained to Molly, right?
Off camera.
Well, you see the the situation. I mean, the penultimate episode is basically supposed to be him having recalled all this to Molly, right?
Right, right. And like that's the thing that bothers me, because why are you showing me this if Henry, the main character, the protagonist, doesn't even get any of this information? And he just goes, oh, nah. I know I've seen these insane things happen to me over the past week where this kid has done these, like, literally I am in a jail cell with this person and they cause a riot to break out and multiple people get shotgunned. And then, Rory Culkin is there and I believe him for some reason, even though he's pinning a murder on me.
The show does have a real problem of delivering information to the audience and then keeping the characters ignorant of that information, or spending a lot of time for the characters to try to learn that information without really using it for dramatic irony or tension or anything. It's just kind of making sure we know what's up in the broader picture, but not using it to make the characters move forward.
And it started to drive me absolutely insane. I was losing my, and it's because we finally got to the last episode. I don't think I can repeat how much I hate this last episode. And Henry is just as like, oh, what's happening? Like, Henry, have you been here? Oh no, you passed out in a car crash and you were in the podcast booth for a while. You don't know anything, because we can't let it, like, it's just like, oh, the plot dictates that Henry doesn't know anything, so he can't. And I'm just like, he's a lawyer. He's obviously very intelligent. He doesn't know any of this. He can't figure it out. Like, he can't even just listen to, he talks to people for a living. He can't talk to the kid. He can't go, hey, answer my questions and we'll go to the little hole. Because that's if a conversation can defeat your entire plot, it's bad.
Certainly not good. Presumably some people liked it. I don't want to discount everybody.
I will say I read the first review I read last night after I watched it. I was just full of rage. And I read the AV Club review, and they're like, it's amazing. And it showed such depth and nuance. I'm like, did we watch the same show? what's going on?
Who is the author, just out of curiosity?
I have no idea. I do not remember off the top of my head. If you search AV Club Castle Rock Finale, you'll find it. It was on my Facebook feed. I just clicked on it because I was like, maybe I can have some, feel some kind of, what's the word?
Catharsis?
Commiseration. I can commiserate. Commiserate with this person. Nope, they loved it. They gave it an A. And I'm, okay. But then I went on.
Strokes for different folks.
Luckily, Andrew, I went on Reddit, and I found many, 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 many more people who felt like I did. Unsurprisingly. If you want anger, just go to Reddit. You'll get some.
That should be their unofficial motto.
It should be. Hey,
you're a source of internet rage.
You need to get angry at something. Here's some people who'll be angry with you. okay, so I've been very mean so far, but I do want to highlight the one shining beacon above everything else. And it's ultimately even more frustrating, because I could see what the show could be if every episode was done as artfully as The Queen, episode 7.
The Ruth episode.
The Ruth episode.
Where we go all Dr. Manhattan with Ruth.
Right, where it's incredible. It's an incredible episode, and no other episode comes close to it.
I like the Molly episode as well. I thought that was very good. Not as good as the Ruth episode, but I thought the Molly episode was good too. And I think it showed something that affects prestige TV writ large, which is that a lot of times these shows feel very amorphous, they feel very rudderless, and they don't have any focus to them. But when they do these highlight, spotlight episodes, they suddenly have to tell one story. And it needs to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a point within 45 minutes. And if you force them to do that, you can dredge some pretty good stuff out of even some not great television programs.
And it's beautiful. this episode. We are following Ruth, who has dementia, who's Alzheimer's, or some sort of degenerative brain disease, and her memory is touch and go. It starts at the very beginning as Henry comes back and he talks to Alan and you know, sun setting and all that stuff. And it repeats throughout the show about multiple times where she loses track of what's going on. And this episode manages to connect all the scenes that we've seen, or not all, but a lot of scenes that we've seen so far up to that point, and connect them in a way with how she sees things, how this affliction has affected her life. And also, maybe she is traveling through time actively? It's hard to say, because the show also is very ambiguous about that.
Yeah, it's pretty unclear as to whether this is all just a fever dream or whether she's actually experiencing these things differently than other people through some supernatural nonsense. They leave it up in the air. But I think we've talked about this before with other things. I think it works on both levels. I think it's a Slaughterhouse-Five thing where if you want to take it as her having actually become unstuck in time, then that's really interesting and has meaningful implications for everything we see. If you just want to take it as a really interesting way to process the idea of dementia and mental deterioration, I think that's really strong as well. And if you could kind of link them together, which the show does for one shining moment, one shining episode, you get something that is pretty damn transcendent and honestly single-handedly justifies the series to me. Like, if they go 5 more seasons and never produce anything that comes even close to that, it will have been artistically worth it for me, because they made that hour of television, which I don't know, was very affecting and very cathartic and very moving and creatively ambitious in both its presentation and the story it was trying to tell. There is a lot of crap to slog through with Castle Rock, that is for sure, but if it just built us up to that moment, honestly, if the season had kind of ended after that episode, I think I'd be like, yeah, there's some things I wanted answers to, but I'm good. I'm satisfied. I'd be okay.
I think it's really good. I don't know if watching all of this was worth it. Sissy Spacek is terrific. In that episode and in the show as a whole. I think all the acting is good. I think all the actors do a good job.
Yeah.
With what they have. Bill Skarsgård is terrifying. He does it. They frame him very well. Every shot makes him look like an other, because he's a big, tall, gaunt thing with sunken eyes. And you're like, is he human?
He is unnerving, that is for sure.
He's really, and it's effective, and he's supposed to be, you know, and it works really well, and it's successfully. I think the only thing it falters on is that it feels very, pointed at, particularly after that episode where you see that, he was just a guy, and he worked on helping people like his mother in real life, in his universe, and you're like, and then you're like, it kind of broke the illusion for me. He's like, they just put eye makeup on him and he just hunches. And it's just like, right. He's not, in retrospect, I think that episode is really, it introduces a lot of things that I wish the show had just never shown me. Like, I wish I had not known that the kid was a person in a different universe, at least not told that directly, because I think it ends up conflicting with a lot of stuff you've are shown, where he's killing a family at their birthday party or whatever it is. You're like,
well, he's also been in a cage for 20 years. I mean, it could have warped him.
I mean, I could buy that it is destroyed him entirely. Like, he's non-functional human, but he's suddenly like this very effective killer that can somehow, that doesn't really matter ultimately. Like, cause a lot of the stuff they show you in the show doesn't ultimately matter. I would not recommend this show, Andrew.
It's a tough call. I guess I would say to people, are you the kind of viewer who can make your way through a lot of not great material in order to get to an hour or two of truly transcendent material? Is that a trade-off you are willing to make? If so, I think this has at least a couple of episodes that are worth your time and make it worth investing in the world. If not, if you need a better hit to miss ratio than that, and if you are walking in knowing that you don't want to be frustrated, even if there's some individual payoffs there, then yeah, I'd say stay away.
Do you think you can just go in cold and watch The Queen and that's it?
I don't think so. I think you at least need to read some Wikipedia entries and better yet, at least into what my wife often does for shows she's not that interested in, but wants to find out what are happening to certain characters and just fast forward all the parts that don't include Sissy Spacek.
I probably would be happier if I just every time the entire podcast studio episode, I just fast forwarded through all that stupid garbage. I don't need that. God. In retrospect.
I'm a completionist. I can't do it. I gotta see it through to the end. Every piece matters, even when every piece doesn't matter.
Oh my God. Why were those two guys out there with their van, their RV, and one had deafened themselves? They knew his dad, and yet we've never. What is going on? Really? They know his dad.
So I have to imagine, I don't know this to be true, have to imagine at some planning stage, it was decided that the deaf man was either an alternate universe version of Henry or an alternate universe version of Wendell or something like that, because it felt like they had to have some twist there that we were never got or not going to get until another season or something, where we just didn't have time for it. I don't know, but I guess I want to believe that they had plans for that and then changed their minds or cut it for time or something. There's a couple of shots that made it feel like they were intentionally visually contrasting the guy with Henry in a way that made me think there was something up. But I may just be trying to unwrap the puzzle box and there's not actually anything there.
This was my theory going into the finale. My theory was, it's not the kid who's causing all this mayhem. It's Henry. Henry.
It's plausible.
Henry is gone. He's in a different part of the country. He comes back. Suddenly, the twist is actually everyone in town is right, and that there is something wrong with Henry, and through no fault of his own. And I understand that probably, considering that he is the black guy in the town, that is a bad thing to, like, it's problematic to make that the hinging thing of your show. But it's the thing that made actually the most sense to me, in that, you know, Henry himself is the problem. The kid is just this weirdo outcast from a different dimension, and it's not, he doesn't actually do anything wrong. He's just being a weirdo around town, or maybe they're connected. Whatever.
It would contradict so many things where just the kid was there and bad things happened immediately around him.
I mean,
not, you know, that the show is consistent in its cosmology when the bad things happen.
I was also going to say, what, like, the show cares about all that? Like, there's plenty of things we're shown that end up not mattering. The murder. I want to talk about the murder historians and that just briefly.
So maybe this is an indictment of the show. I have no idea who you're talking about.
The people who set up the murder bed and breakfast.
Oh, yeah. The professor and his wife.
Right. Or the recently... the ex-professor.
Yes. No, he's still a professor. He's just not actively professing anymore.
Oh, that's right. He has tenure, so he's impossible to fire. that's what I wanted. That tone. That's what I expected from the whole show. Because those people felt distinctly... That felt like a Stephen King short story, you know.
And it's another instance where the show, for just like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, decided to focus on one thing and move this little story forward and tell you who these people were, because it had to do it economically, and in a short period of time, it had more direction and purpose and character than a lot of the other things the show did.
And it had a degree of levity. Like, and a degree of weird humanity in it. Like quirk, like those quirks are a thing, but like I could those that's in, like those people have an interest in something in their life, and I think that's the other upsetting. Like I can't. What does Henry like to eat? What does Henry like to do? Does he have interests? I don't know any of them. At least these two, this couple, I know. Oh, they had this business idea about weird murder tourism. All right, that's something. And they frame it well with those. You see those weird mannequins around, and you're like, what the hell is going on? Why do they have all these mannequins? And then you're like, oh, okay, I get it. I see. And then they actually turn into murderers because of the kid or whatever. And then, of course, Jackie has to kill one with an axe.
Here's Jackie.
Hey, Andrew, are you right in season two?
How dare you insult me with such a thing?
And that leads to me my next question. Are you at all curious about season two?
It'll probably be one of those things where I wait and see if the buzz is good or bad. And if it's good enough, I may at least give it a shot. But the early returns are not promising.
Yeah, the problem is, like, if you do a show, if you do a season that is, oh, we go back to the Overlook and it's 2018, you know, it is 2018, time has passed, we can reframe some of the things that The Shining was about and reframe it in 2018 and modernize it, and you have a female main character this time instead of Jack, you have Jackie, that makes a difference. The problem is, I imagine that largely the same people will be working on it, or at least in charge.
I was going to say that I think that's my hesitation for season two, is that if I look at season one, I go, it has a really great cast. It has a very interesting premise with some good potential for both plot and theme. It has high production values. Those things are as good as they're presumably going to be. You know, maybe you suddenly break the bank and pull in some Oscar winning actors and something else. But it seems like most of those things are maximized. And the big flaw is in the writing and the plotting. And I don't know that that's going to change if you just poured everything over to the Overlook Hotel or to, I don't know, you know, some other Stephen King locale, if they go to Salem's Lot or God knows what else, or to the town from The Mist. The things that are good about the show, or the things that make me interested in the show, are as good as I imagine them to be, or as good as I imagine they can be. So I guess if I'm hopping on board for season two, then I'm doing so in the hope that the writing improves. And there was not a lot of cause to expect that here.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't, if it's going to be like this again, stay away from The Shining. The Shining, the novel, is good. It's one of the best King novels. Its reputation is deserved. And please stay away from it. Don't, if you're going to have a fun time with it and play with the tropes and, you know, like that's my only hope, in that maybe this character of Jackie, because she is the quote, because she is Britta, it will inspire a little bit more flamboyance with the plot. And because the Overlook Hotel is such a colorful setting, like it would make, just don't be so dark and like have some life, make it. And if you're just commit, and I don't, if it's just going to be this again, go to like a lesser known Stephen King book and do that. Go to one that people don't immediately recognize, but it makes perfect sense. Like I could see that in them. I could see the meeting in my head. They're like, all right, season one, we don't want to get in too over our heads, so we start in Maine. You know, we'll do it in a town in Maine, cast whatever, whichever one. And then season two, we go straight to The Shining. We start at Shawshank, and then we go to The Shining. Those, everyone knows those. We don't need to. You don't need to read the books. Everyone knows Shawshank. Everyone knows The Shining. We're good. Season three, maybe we, who knows? We do it again, because, God, well, Bill, he's around.
You got to do something to loop in the casuals.
Yes, and I don't know. They keep talking about a Dark Tower television show. I'll probably give that a shot because I'm a sucker, but I don't have any hope. I had hope for this, and they're shattered. This is not good.
This is putting it charitably.
I
think it is a 10-episode slog with occasional transcendent bright spots that almost make it worth the slog.
I wish that if someone could just take the Queen and sell it as, this is what Dementia is like, starring Sissy Spacek, and just throw it out there and let, like, figure it out through, even as an art, like, as a mood piece. It doesn't even have to make sense. You don't have to know the characters. You're just like, hey, she's wandering around through her life and seeing weird, crazy stuff happen. Like, it's really really inventive and creative, and the show just nothing. Like, I was really hooked. I was really interested. I'm like, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to go? And then it's just, like, every time, I'm like, oh. And it just dawned on me as we went. It was like, there's nothing around the corner, really. Like, some people die, but I'm sorry, Alan died. That's really the only character that I was like, shucks.
Yeah, I didn't care about the corrections officer with the heart of gold or the warden. Or I guess I cared about the professor and his wife, briefly. Just as we were getting to know them and find them interesting, they got axed, so.
I will say, you know, their flawed relationship was fun.
It was at least interesting in a way that fewer non-Deaver-specific relationships were.
Yes. It's very strange that they homed in on them. And it's so late in the series, too. You're like, why couldn't we see little peaks like this throughout? Like, if they did that every... Like, if that was a reoccurring a bit, where, like, we see it with that weird family and their birthday party, and we see it with the murder tourism people, and not... Like, everyone else is just, like, prisoners, prison guards, wardens. Like,
red shirts.
Red shirts, yeah. People I don't care. Like, I don't care about them. I'm sorry. I don't care. Like, it's very strange that they frame the kid as, like, oh, yeah, he kills people, but it's usually bad people. Like, the dude in the prison, the associate warden or whatever he was, where he's like, yeah, I served in Iraq. And I tortured people, and then he dies. And you're like, okay, good. He seemed like a bad person.
Swift sense of justice.
Yeah, right? I'm like a white supremacist who the kid is stuck in a cell with. And I'm like, oh, he died of cancer? Okay. Or all those prisoners who are, like, jeering and threatening people. I'm like, well, were the corrupt prison guards? I'm like, okay, I don't. Maybe I'm sorry the police officers got killed, but they seem pretty dumb. So I don't know what to do about any of this.
And it's okay to kill stupid people in Robbie's world.
I mean, when it's the ninth episode of it. No, that is in the finale, actually. When it's in the finale of a television show, which I am desperately hoping for something to mean anything, I'm starting to say, yeah, kill everyone. I don't care. It becomes, it just, I'm like, I don't care about these. They're not real people. They're not even characters. They're
cannon fodder.
Yeah, they're just like, they're cardboard cutouts. Like, oh, shoot them with a shotgun. I don't care. What does it matter? Something's happening, at least. It's not our main character just unconscious in a car for 6 hours. It is, and that's real, that almost broke. I almost turned it off at that point, Andrew. Really. I was looking at how much time was left in the episode, in the finale, and I'm like, there's no way. They can't do this. I was like, there was 18 minutes left. Oh, there's no way. There's nothing. They can't pull this out in 18 minutes. I'm done. I was just like waiting for, and then, okay. And he's in, how does he get the kid back to Shawshank without anyone noticing?
Because they're all evacuated, right? That's part of the idea.
What happened to the fire?
I don't know. It was put out by, let's say, Mo.
That's what I mean. There's just all this stuff. Like, it should mean something when you have a... all these things. And they forget about it. He's just, oh, I'm just a small town lawyer. Oh, here's a pun. here's a pun about bushes with this befuddled, frustrated man who has forgotten about my terrible history with dozens and dozens of murders. He sure was fast to hire me as a lawyer because he doesn't want to have to pay a tax on his property because of bushes.
Look, honey, you should better, you may as well hire him. If not, he might kill you.
Are there no lawyers? There's no other lawyers in Castle Rock. Like, Molly is successful only... She's only alive because there's no other real estate agents. The only reason Henry gets a job as a lawyer because there are no other lawyers in Castle Rock. Everyone has left.
There you go. Captive audience.
The fire. Fire disappears. Why is he in prison in Shawshank? Why would you keep him so far away? He does that every day. He drives out to the prison every day to this abandoned prison. No one's noticed.
Because you don't want that evil seeping out to other people. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Is that way
madness lies?
He's living in his mother's old house, right?
Because yes, I take that to be the case.
And there literally was the same cell in the basement. Why doesn't he move that cell down?
Because that was too close. That was near. I think the implication is that maybe that is what helped contribute to his dad going crazy.
That's my review of Castle Rock season one is the sideshow. It's the sideshow Bob Rake noise. That's what I've contribute ultimately. Andrew, is there anything else you would like to say about Castle Rock?
More and better work for Sissy Spacek. She was great and deserves recognition for this, and I hope that she gets more to do in other shows. And I thought I apologize, I can't pronounce her last name, but Melanie
Linsky.
I thought she did a very good job as well, and deserves to be in more things.
All the actors did a great job. Yeah, frankly, yeah, it's not their fault. I don't blame them. They wrung as much as they could out of this messy thing. Apparently, Sissy Spacek is in tons of things recently. So she was in a television show from 2015 to 2017, and then in Castle Rock and in Homecoming, another television show also in 2018.
All right, well, then I need to broaden my horizons.
I don't know what Homecoming... Homecoming is a psychological thriller that centers on a caseworker, Heidi, at a facility treating soldiers returning from war, and Walter, a veteran eager to rejoin civilian life.
Mm-hmm. Premise with some legs.
Sissy's only in 7 out of 10 episodes, but... It's Julia Roberts' show. What? Julia Roberts is in a television show now? What's happening? When did this happen?
News to me.
Where what is this aired? Where did this? Is this on broadcast television? It's 10 episodes. It can't be. So Netflix, Amazon Prime. Where are we? Come on, tell IMDb. Tell me. I don't know. Maybe it's not out yet.
I saw a picture of Julia Roberts promoting something in a headline somewhere. So maybe it's upcoming.
It comes out in November. That's why. It's on Amazon Prime.
There you go.
There's another Sissy Spacek vehicle. She's only 7 episodes, but it's something. Andrew. What would you like to tell the fine folks at home to check out?
Fine folks at home, if they're interested in hearing more of my rants and occasional compliments and praises for great television shows and movies, I can find everything, links to all of my writing from all across the web at my website, which is theandrewblog.net. You can also find my writing as part of Consequence of Sounds, expanded TV and film coverage. And you can find me on Twitter at theandrewblog. And as always, Robbie... Thank you for having me, even when we have to discuss shows that cause you to make unpleasant noises.
Thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining me.
Anytime.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and the show's website is serialfanaticist.com. You can follow the Facebook page for the show at facebook.com/serialfanaticist. If you like the show, give it 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcatcher service you use. Subscribe. Tell your friends. Word of mouth helps. I appreciate it. I thank you for all the help you provide. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.